All right. Well, we got Robert here too, and he can rally as well. So we're in good hands. Thanks, Mark. We did get notice too that before the meeting that Clay has a competing issue, so he's not able to attend either. So he's excused. And just since we're announcing things, I have a dental appointment like real close to 12, so I am going to try to be out of here at 11:45 if we can. If not, I will. We have a follow up that we could take later if we don't get completed. It's 11 o'clock. I'm going to call our meeting to order. I'm trying to organize my notepad here. Looks like we have a few people online. 5 people online. I'm going to call the meeting to order and welcome everybody. I will go around and have everybody quickly introduce themselves. I'm Duff Mitchell, the co-chair, and we can count that as roll call just to keep things going. I'm going to turn it over to Robert to introduce himself and for a roll call.
Good morning. Robert Venables, I'm the executive director for Southeast Conference, filling the seat economic development on the Energy Security Task Force, and co-chair with Mr. Mitchell here.
Great. And then Michael, I'll hand it off to you, and you can go from there.
Michael Yaffe, Michael Baker, and then I believe everyone else on the call is with Michael Baker, so Mark Lucan and then Malia. So.
Excellent. All right, well, let's dive in. Robert has done his homework. I was at a conference earlier this week and with Curtis presenting to the National Hydropower Association, and he was making a joke about how he had all of his notes and how everyone talks about your homework getting eaten by a dog. He's got a new Labrador puppy, and he held it up, and it was literally chewed up. I think Brandy Dixon saved him by bringing in a copy of what was on the thing. Otherwise, it was a pretty and he was going to try from a pretty messed up document. Speaking of homework, we got Robert's homework in, and I got some of mine in that I sent out this morning, and I know that we all have not had time to digest any of those, but it is comforting that we're making some progress. So let's dive in. We got the overview and objectives and the purpose of the meeting. We're trying to get where we're taken from action items to a more fleshed out state with steps like the data energy committee suggested, and or with the next step, an executive summary format for recommendations for public input, but then also to be turned over to decision makers for execution, including the governor's recommendations. So as I was going through, Michael, I would like you to pull this up, the action items. Again, I'm very sensitive to refining a task and purpose.
So, Steph, I have the tracking sheet, and then also we've been saving on the SharePoint. So, hi, Curtis.
Hello. Good morning.
So, Steph, we've been saving the kind of write-ups that you and Robert have been writing. They're all on the SharePoint site now under subcommittee and then coastal, and then there's a folder for write-ups. Draft write-ups. And so I even have the one that you just sent prior to the start of the meeting. And then I know you've been updating in green the ones that you've been working on. I think the one you just sent may not be updated, but
gotcha.
I also right before I checked this, I know you might have saved a separate copy. Here it looks like it has last modified updates.
Oh yeah, I might have done that just so that I didn't know if I was it might have had some of the IS the incentives and subsidies. It may, but I don't know if it included any updates to the coastal. I may have saved that for that purpose.
I think that's the version I currently have open, if that makes sense to you.
Yeah, that's great. Great.
Okay.
So just for situation awareness, what I did was, as I'm drafting up the action item, an action name that I'm working on, I try to succinctly put it into, you know, we're going to do this for the purpose of X, and trying to keep it succinct, but also give the compelling reason why and wherefore, and try to move out the passive, you know, like the words evaluate, which really doesn't mean anything to anybody except that we're going to look at something. And so I wanted to move more into action items. And that doesn't mean that these don't need more work and more action emphasis. But anyways, that's the steps that I took. So we have this agenda. So I just want to kind of let everyone know, and I believe when in our last meeting that you were saying, Michael, you can save previous versions or this. I felt comfortable with updating these because you can save previous versions, correct?
Yes. So anything that's saved on SharePoint or Teams, for that matter, if you hit that drop down up here and go to version history, we can go back in time. And I think this is just a new file, so this is when you first modified it.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sorry for creating a new file. I just wanted to, it's part of my operator headspace timing of trying to work with SharePoint.
That's okay. We can help with the version control.
So we don't have anybody from the public on. Robert, you know, we can start with wherever you'd like. I'm trying to get these in. We don't want to necessarily expose and have to have you digest or me have to digest what we've just recently done. But I would comment that we're generally on track with calibrating the action items that we've laid forward.
Yeah. I think it'd be good, you know, to go ahead and just throw up on the screen each one of those. You know, this is part of the public record, and so it'd be good just kind of throw each one up for a moment to have it captured in case someone's reviewing the recordings later, and just kind of take a minute to walk through it and note it for the record.
Perfect. Yeah, no, that's a good idea.
Okay.
And we should also mention to the public that these are all drafts.
Mm-hmm.
Work in progress.
Is there any one in particular you want to start with, or?
Yeah, Robert, you picked which one you want to start with.
Yeah, I mean, we set the time aside. Let's start at the top and walk through.
Okay. It's opening up on my other monitor. I'm just dragging it over. I can zoom in.
Okay, so I'm gonna. All right, you're gonna grab me first for
that was discussion. That was at the top.
It was at the top of the list. So you had your dealer's choice. if you would prefer to do something else, we can do that too, Robert.
No. It serves me right. I'm excited about this topic. So happy to have it on the list. And one of the, you know, action items that we had identified was the beneficial electrification of the Alaska Marine Highway System fleet, which by extension, you know, really refers more to maritime as well. So we've already partnered with DOT on the ferry research project. I did put the link to that final paper in the chat box, so you can capture that for the both the record and for the reference. In case somebody wants to dive into that in a lot more detail, but really excited about what this opportunity brings to the table. And so if you want to just scroll down to those last three, you know, here we go right there. Now, yeah, capture the how we get there. Just a tad.
Yeah. If you want.
There you go. Oh, all right. So we already have, the state has funding in hand already to begin this. And there's about, three, four more years of funding availability in order to secure what we need for additional ferries and different additional infrastructure shoreside to support those needs. And so, the battery energy storage system, which, you know, I see that as really a common thread through a lot of the recommendations and many of the subcommittees. And so one of the things I'll be you're looking for at the broader task force level is making sure that our technology is in alignment, that, you know, we have standardization across the state. And so, taking a look at how this plays a role, not just for, there's nothing that there can be in my world, we don't go after single solutions. Every solution has to meet more than one need. And so when you talk about beneficial electrification of the fleet, we're taking a look at, you know, a number of different things when it comes to the financial viability of the fleet, to securing better jobs, to lowering emissions, to just the shoreside benefits that happen. So some of those strategies are listed, in this document here, and they're certainly expounded on in the fuller document. We try to capture those highlights here and a timeline of, you know, securing the funding and then the longer mid-range of the actual design and construction of the infrastructure, including vessels. So that's kind of a synopsis of what we think is the exciting future of this this task action item.
Excellent. Well, thank you for initiating this. If we could go through this, I'd like to ask a question. I know you're incorporating quite a bit with BESS, but isn't BESS kind of like a function of or an additive of shoreside charging, or is that the main focus of the shoreside charging?
That's a considerable focus of the shoreside charging. We're not looking at any currently, we're not looking at any direct connections to the grid. What gives the communities the most benefit is when you can do time of day charging and not competing with peak usage. And so we really see whether it's a diesel generating community or a hydro, the availability and waste of that the spinning reserve, et cetera, that's just sitting there. It happens off peak, and so we want to capture that. And so we see the BESS as a strategic strategy in that, but we haven't gone through the whole vetting system. These are just early recommendations and findings.
Yeah, and I understand. Maybe I haven't had the opportunity to read the paper. I do know, talking to Commissioner Anderson, that there was discussions on how BESS would be, how charging would best occur, and I didn't know that there was a limitation, and maybe we shouldn't have one with direct connections to the grid. That creates a balancing and network issues, and some communities are set up for that, and some clearly are not. But I don't think that should be off the table. Just like shore power is connected directly to shore power for cruise ships are connected directly to the grid. Again, I haven't seen the work paper. And I think, speaking of the work paper, we should embed that in as a link somewhere in the document, because that's going to be important for people, not just us, but for the public to, you know, taking Robert's suggestion, we should embed that as a resource link.
Yeah. And, you know, I would just say that technically you can certainly, do direct grid, but remember the number one objective of the Energy Task Force and of the Alaska Energy Authority and our charge is to lower the cost of energy to Alaskans. And so finding those strategies that fully utilize that load 24 hours a day we just need to match up the infrastructure and the processes to achieve that.
Sure. And economies of scale, when you're charging a ferry, that could be a significant economy of scale to a smaller community, whether it's direct or it has to be added on. So I just don't want to have to be married to a BESS. I mean, but it clearly makes a lot of sense. The other thing I want to point out on the BESS is that we have a whole task force action item that covers BESS for grid stability, for grid security, and other issues. And we heard some of the same with some other comments before. So another question I have, you got floating versus shoreside. Can you explain what you mean by that? Because I don't know if you're meaning the BESS floating or shoreside, or you're talking about the shoreside charging.
Actually, there has been suggestions that that both could be considered. As you're taking a look at recharging maritime vessels that are underway constantly, whether it be barges or potentially ferries, that there are models out there that have floating islands to do that. And that's less with shoreside recharging. That has other fuel implications for converting to energy. So that's just one of those futuristic ideas that have been suggested.
Gotcha. I just know lithium ion battery energy systems, it would be foolhardy to put those as a floater. They tend to go up in flames as they hit salt water, so it's just a safety issue. But I didn't know, you can use other BESS systems or energy storage systems other than lithium ion. So appreciate that. I was just curious. Maybe we could just elaborate more of what that is. All right, implementation timeline. My question is that, talking to Senator Murkowski, you need to spend the money in the next 1 to 4 years, and this is once in a generational opportunity, and then the money's gone. And so how does that implementation timeline work with the sources of funds if we're going to rely on federal funding? I know we got 5 to 10 years to complete design and construction. That's for the vessels? Is that for the short? I'm just trying to understand the...
So the word spend is often generalized or recharacterized as obligated. So we just have to have those federal funds obligated, and because it takes time. So getting vessels under construction, getting shoreside designs and contracted out. So getting it all contracted out, federal funding secured in the next 3 to 5 years, get it under contract, and then it's going to take an additional period of time to execute. But all those funds will be obligated.
Gotcha. And then the other thing is with the AMSS ferries, we have also private electrification ferries or discussions from Gold Belt or like the Haynes to Skagway. Is that, and again, I'm not privy to the report, so is that in the report as well?
The Haynes to Skagway is intended to be part of the AMHS fleet that's in there, and all the lessons learned and indication, information there is definitely applicable to private sector opportunities as well.
Okay.
And, one of the things that Southeast Conference has long advocated for is shared resources of public infrastructure, whether it's ferry terminals, or private-public partnerships with the BESS system. So your ferries don't come nearly as often as the community wants, which means you've got an asset there that can help secure terrestrial electric vehicles, or it can be used for other maritime. You mentioned one of the native corporations. And so I think this broad application that these things, if designed with community solutions in mind, will give us broad application and help us achieve the goals that we're looking for to lower the cost of energy to Alaskans.
Right. And then I want to be able to review this and review the shore power paper, and I also want to look at and incorporate maybe what other systems in Norway and Washington and others doing, not for more studies, but we may want to look at lessons learned. I know that there's a big difference between shore power generation 1 and shore power generation 5. And where I'm going at is that ferries have very quick time schedules to meet. They have to load, unload passengers, unload traffic, add people on. And so quick disconnect and connect configurations are absolutely essential in this domain, so to say. Because if it takes a half hour to connect something and then you only got 10 minutes of charge, because you got to turn the ferry around and not hold it up, it creates things. So I think that there's a technology aspect to make sure that, you know, as we're investing here, we're getting best of breed, or we're getting tried and proven, quick and disconnect times. What's your thoughts on that, Robert?
Well, I could show you on my personal phone because I was there. We went to Norway. Alaskans need to stay away from reinventing the wheel. Right. We don't have the time, energy, funding, or expertise. So knowledge transfer is key to what we do. And I think that's why what some of the Scandinavian countries are doing is so informative to us. I went with the state of Alaska, Lhasa Alaska, to Norway last summer to observe what they're doing, and they are doing applied research in so many different areas. And so one of the things that we saw, and I tell folks that, you know, my hope is with this arrangement there that we can, you know, get charged in and on our way in half an hour and say, you know, it could be done in 10, 15 minutes. Well, I watched as the ferry came in, and as it's docking, as the vehicle ramp is going down, the cradle's opening, and the plug is automatically unwheeling towards its socket, it is fully recharged in 7 minutes, and well before the cars have exchanged, and it's on its way within 30. So the technology is already out there. It's well proven, and it's a basis of finding out its application to Alaska, where in Alaska, and then standardizing that for use so that it makes sense and gives us the efficient and effective application.
No, that sounds wonderful. Yeah, I know quick disconnect times and quick times are that ferry captain wants to turn around and make his schedule.
Yep.
So, yeah. Any comments from any of the crew, Michael Baker, or if we have anyone on that has joined on from Black and Beach?
I don't have any comments, but I open it up to my colleagues if they do.
I have a question. This is Audrey. On your summaries, are you putting or identifying maybe it's another section of these summaries, listing potential organizations that will or should be involved if the projects end up moving forward? I'm thinking, you know, just like kind of pre-advance or brainstorm some potential stakeholders, DOT, the local utility, the local municipality, Alaska Energy Authority.
I'm bouncing around, but to your point on the tracking kind of worksheet, we do look at kind of lead organizations and partners and collaborators. We don't have that called out in the write-up, but that's something that, you know, we can easily go back and just add in because we do have that information being tracked.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, and let us know, Audrey. My impression was that AEA was leading the terrestrial charge, and DOT was going to stick with the maritime side of things. But if you want AEA to add on here, I mean, we hardly do anything without communication with the state's energy office. But DOT is kind of taking the lead on that, and then they've got to, we're working with them to coordinate utility and community interaction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes sense. DOT being take the lead because the fair, you know, they run the ferry system.
Right.
Just a side note, we are involved with port electrification, but as it relates to cruise ships, at least one project now and potentially more in the future.
Yeah, and I think that's where having as much communication so we don't get silos because, you know, Doc's mm-hmm. already mentioned some of the private corporations looking at, you know, maritime electrification, the green corridor of the cruise ships and the marine highway system. You have the Nevy on the shore side. So there's a lot of initiatives, and if everyone picks a different type of technology that's not standardized or compatible, nothing's the same, but it needs to be as standardized and compatible as possible for the ease of both parts, ease of operations, and the ease of operations and maintenance as well. So appreciate your comments.
Yeah, those are well-founded, Audrey. I appreciate that. And speaking of DOT, in your write-up here, Robert, were you able, or was this independently done by you, or were you incorporating any staff from DOT, since they would be likely to help execute this?
The DOT is right alongside there. They had a peer review at both the state and federal level, so this has had some pretty good eyes on this as well. So.
On the executive summary or specifically the paper?
The whole report.
Oh, the whole report. On this executive summary, was there any input that they had, or were they given the opportunity to put any input on this?
On this paper right here?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, I mean, but it came out of stuff that they had already weighed in on, so.
Fair enough. Yeah, thanks. You answered the question. I mean, these are still drafts, and, you know, these are going to go through public comment periods and others, and, you know, if there's any, anything that they may want to add or like to add, it may be nice to incorporate or their views go forward.
Yeah, listen, so nobody wanted to get up with me at 4:30 this morning so I could be ready to start it. Sorry.
Fair enough. And hey, this is an evolution, so we're always sharpening and getting better. So 4:30, hey, we're now 10:30. Well, thank you. If there isn't any other questions on the draft for the ferry electrification, we can move on to another Michael, if you don't mind, since we're already on the Marine Highway, let's go down either to shore power, which is related, or the battery energy storage system, which kind of that way is still staying fresh with the last task that we just talked about.
Sure. Just can you just point me to which one?
Yeah, you're on shore power right there. That one's fine or the best.
Okay.
So under the task and purpose on this one, again, I tried to use action items, plan, fund, and execute shore power at public and private cruise docks to sell excess energy to cruise ships, spur renewable energy development, and use economies of scale to lower the cost over time for industry and Alaskans by building industry-leading energy infrastructure. As we've heard in previous discussions and those of us that have been involved with a little bit of shore power, it's more than what we heard in the last executive summary, it's more than just putting the contraption at the dock. There's a whole supply chain that goes back from the dock, from not just the connection, but how do you run the line to the dock, how you connect that to the grid, whether you have a battery energy storage system at the dock or you have a battery energy storage system on the grid, it's really irrelevant as long as it provides the function. I did not really address battery energy storage in this particular one, and we might be able to add that in there. But so we have an opportunity to become an industry-leading in our infrastructure, in our shoreside communities, and the volume of cruise ship energy taken in any given day in Southeast Alaska at times could surpass what many of the communities currently use. So background, Alaska set the standard for cruise ship shore power in Juneau, a model now global. I was talking to STEM and Technic, and I think they're now on the fifth generation of advancement of shore power that what was incorporated in Juneau. But Juneau definitely was the leader. I think Juneau even had a steam plant because they didn't know if it was going to work, so they had a backup steam plant that they spent more than $1 million on that was never used. But anyways, so I I'm mentioning that because we started it, but now we've lost our lead on it where other focuses, like what Robert said, there's other places in the world that have just eclipsed what we have. Anyways, the shore power system benefits cruise lines financially, extends their stay in Alaska ports, and fortifies our coastal grids. I was talking to our DOE Act, Department of Environmental Conservation Acting Commissioner Emma Pokin, and she was explaining how ships have to slow down and reduce their speed in order to meet annual emissions, which then harms and hurts our local economies and our ports because that means there's less time for tourists to be spending in our ports. So all modern cruise ships, including those being built today, are shore power compatible. I've talked to the cruise industry leaders, and they are saying when they go in for refitting, they're not only going in for shore power, but in many cases they're being outfitted with shore power for either port or starboard side of the vessel. And so if they're not already shore power compatible, if they plan on staying long in the service fleet, they will become. We also heard that natural gas ships and others are also including shore power. So regardless of the primary propulsion method or fuel source, I think shore power is here to stay. Seward and Whittier, with their utilities, are now developing these facilities. Efficient shore power involves precise transmission infrastructure, substations, and quick connect equipment for cruise ships requiring between 3 and 8 megawatts. And then I added in from Juneau's perspective, and this is directly from ALMP's transmission tariff advices that they share with the RCA for the last several years. The Princess Dock, which is fully utilized, it's a good data point for extrapolating other docks that if they have the same season and the same number of ships, they will be over 6,000, and then they can extrapolate from there because it's shipped from a known point. You know, if they only have half the number of ships or half the number of port calls, they can figure out within reason for electric utility managers of what to plan for. Such infrastructure investments not only help the cruise industry, but they bolster community resilience and present affordable energy alternatives. And what I mean by that is you're now like what Mr. Binkley suggested, when you're adding additional substations and additional infrastructure, those things are used in the winter as well by our local communities. So it helps reduce the cost of power for Alaskans. It also helps spread those costs over a larger number of kilowatts sold, which can help new generation as well as pay for infrastructure. So it's a great resource of energy sales for Alaskan utilities, coastal communities. And then the value proposition, by spearheading shore power, Alaska boosts its grid reliability, attracts local energy investments, and showcases greener emissions-free ports, which also enhance our global appeal for marketing. Alaska shore power task and purpose propels job growth, infrastructure enhancement, supports industries, augments energy resilience, and slashes energy bills for its residences. Now, all of those value propositions, there's a bunch of levers in there, so you could do things wrongly and not accomplish those, but if you do them right, you should be able to. So how we get there, and I took the liberty of using AEA in here, and that's agnostic. We could say, hey, state or how, but I was trying to pin the tail, you know, where maybe this could go. I have not discussed with AEA or any of these other entities, so this would be up for discussion with particularly those agencies, but also, you know, to try to assign where this would go so it's not just generically out there that the state should do it. So put out AEA provides technical oversight and assistance to communities, IPPs, and electric utilities, local utilities develop short.
I think his connection just...
Give him a minute to reboot if need be. There's been a lot of technical issues sporadic for some reason throughout Southeast today, so I don't know if it's systematic or...
Well, at least he's not making a funny face.
I've seen that. That's a tough one to try to erase from a public proceeding that is captured forever. So yesterday's Rail Belt group, they end up with a whole list of these type of conclusions?
So they did. They took the approach. They started at the end in terms of what were their goals, and it was almost as if, you know, what for the scenario kind of planning, you know, modeling, you know, what would they want long term, mid term, and near term in terms of the energy generation mix, and then create actions around that. And so they got as far as developing the actions, and then they assigned people for the write up. So I think that's what they're focusing on now.
Nice. Welcome back, Doug.
Yeah. No, I was going along. I could see myself and hear myself, obviously. I was just going through these, and we don't need to go through each one. You kind of get the idea, unless you want me to run through all these. And I'm more than happy to have the public and Robert review all these, including AEA. And I would really love if Audrey's already deeply involved with the other communities. There's probably some really good input or lessons learned or some of the strategies that they have used thereof on this.
Can you just scroll down to the bottom bolded section there? Let's just talk about that for a second. Okay. So they've got broad goals.
Yeah. With the governor's mandate that we reduce the cost of energy. You know, I'll just say that, you know, when I first talked about shore power with our former representative, Don Young, he said, you know, these cruise ships, they're foreign owned. They're not hiring American workers. There tend to be foreign workers owned, and yes, we need to support the industry, but, you know, these guys aren't paying their fair share. And I explained to him that out of the 6,000 megawatt hours that Princess drops into Juneau, you know, it's bringing in $600,000 to $700,000 a year at those energy costs, and it would be higher if the energy cost is higher. That's bringing in a real family wage jobs of connecting, disconnecting, and providing opportunities. And that money, underneath certain tariff processes, and I'm not going to get into everybody's micro analysis of tariffs because each city and each utility is different, but those monies tend to be returned back to the ratepayers. So it does, in fact, reduce the cost of energy very clearly as you spread those kilowatts over. And that doesn't matter whether it's firm power or interruptible power. If you have 6,000 megawatt hours in your system and it's firm power, it's still being money's applied for the transmission, distribution, and administrative costs through economies of scales. And we have non-operating fuel costs in any of our communities. So if you're able to spread those kilowatts over a larger pool, you're clearly and without argument decreasing the cost of power for our residents. So I just want us to focus, and what I did when I'm writing these expected results, I wanted to focus on our task force mission, which, Governor Dunleavy said, it's the moonshot, get me 10-cent power. And any micro step that we can in order to get to that goal is going in the right direction. So the only other thing I did was that EPA has a shore power technology assessment. It's a little bit dated, but it is a reference source. And then I know Westing Air Brake Technology, WABTEC, and it's actually Stemmann Technik, is their German subsidiary. And by the way, Westinghouse Air Brake Technology, for those that aren't aware, is the largest railroad engine producer in the in North America. In fact, they have like a 95% market share. They're very heavily invested in the shore power operations. I'm sure when Robert was in Norway, there was some of the operations from them that they're using, because I can read from their literature that they're in heavily into Norway and the Norwegian ferries. So I just mention that as resources. We do not need to list resources, but I just kind of wanted to capture, some of the data points for the public and for others. Michael, if you could go up just a little bit, I just want to keep going down to the last, AEA provides engineering systems, system pre-engineered systems. I just want to show that I did incorporate local battery energy storage systems into the shore power to enable local utilities to ramp up and provide quick connect and disconnect times using late generation technologies. What I have learned in talking with Stemmann Technik and others is that cruise ships are a 3 to 8 megawatt mini city. You don't just come to the grid or even the battery energy storage system and plug. You have to ramp up your hydropower assets for grid stability, and hydropower, because it's flowing water, and it's not like a natural gas generation where you can actually have a peak plant, it takes time to stabilize the frequencies and all the engineering aspects of ensuring that you don't burn up the ship system, but you also don't burn up the grid system. And so a battery energy storage system becomes the shock absorber. But that being said, you still need quick disconnect and connect times for that ramping. So that's definitely a value proposition or issue that needs to be resolved in the design of these systems. Anyhow, any questions on this particular in executive summary?
Good.
All right. Then, Michael, since we're already talking kind of battery energy storage system, can we go down to the BESS ESS one, just because it's kind of, how would I say, on the same pathway or some of the overarching connections. So this action item is separate from shore power and electrification of ferries, because battery energy storage systems provide power reliability and grid stability to any system, whether you're shore power or not. They also allow you to integrate wind, solar, and micro hydropower into your systems where they might not be the best time of day use or where that particular resource can be integrated. So battery energy storage systems are becoming quite prevalent in almost all utilities down south that have either a solar or a wind regime connected to their grid. I think this is an older version, and we're going to continue with this. I had Mark Lucan, and I also had David Burlingame from EPS look at this, and I noticed the version that I put up here did not have David Burlingame's comments, but the comments on the supercapacitor, David Burlingame was asking us to take out because it's too new, and he would be reluctant to until it's tried and proven with the supercapacitor system, he would be reluctant to advise that to his clients until it's more tested out. He said, I don't really want to see us being a guinea pig on technology. And so I modified that a little bit. And so stand by that this draft is a 914. I probably should have sent in my 915 draft, which incorporated David's comments. But let's continue with this, since this is what we have. It just goes on to explain the background of a battery energy storage system. It really simply BESS stores electrical energy for use at a later time. It's pretty agnostic. Most of the technology right now is lithium ion. There is other systems. There's a compressed air system that they're using a salt cavern in the lower 48 that works effectively with compressed air. There's other forms of storage, but lithium ion is the, I would say, has the largest market share at this time for BESS. And BESS also, just for situational awareness, you can ask it and you design it with battery chemistry and with recharge capabilities, whether it's a 15-minute hold, whether it's a multi-hour hold, or whether it's to like handle a one-hour emergency outage. And all of those factors change the cost as well as how much battery system you need, and then also the composition of the batteries going into it, because you serve different purposes by that. So the battery chemistry and also the demand functionality of the BESS needs to be sized and properly orchestrated. So if we can move down the advantages. So grid stability and reliability, peak shaving, integrations of renewables, microgrids and energy independence, reduced transmission and distribution investment. By placing BESS in strategic locations, you can forestall or even eliminate the need for additional transmission and distribution investments off into the future. Load leveling. And then an important one, because you can look at all of the coastal communities' outages with RCA and with FERC 1 reports and reports that they turn in, and we're very acceptable to outages. Not everybody built their transmission lines and their distribution lines with APLEX standards, which is the Aviation Protection Line Committee standards, because Eagles have a wingspan greater than most distribution systems, and so we're very acceptable to environmental outages. And so if you can move down a little bit, Michael, for the backup and emergency power, I think that's an important benefit that provides utilities, especially hospitals and people on emergency life support systems or, you know, CPAP machines or other things. A BESS system can really reduce the outage times of communities or community utilities. And that has a factor because if you're outage, you're not selling electricity. And if you're not selling electricity, now you're spending money rather than getting things. And the best utility is where you never even know they're there. You just plug and turn it on the light and it always works. And battery energy storage systems help that grid resiliency and that emergency power. Best systems support electric vehicle charging. Same as with Robert's write-up with battery energy storage systems with Ferry. You can have a remote battery energy charging system along a highway or someplace where it's far away for the grid or it's on the grid, but it's further away for servicing. And you can have a battery energy storage system that goes from DC to DC charge very quickly and it could charge vehicles. And then it doesn't cause a strain on the local grid by having that absorption. If you had trucks or multiple advanced chargers at any one given time, you had, let's say, 15 vehicles all charging at a high rate of DC, that could have an impact on a grid or a distribution grid. So same kind of benefit thinking of where Robert was going with the ferries. Economics with suitable RCA regulatory structures in place. Best operations can pay for themselves by providing various grid services from frequency regulation to capacity services. David Burlingame, he made a comment that you gotta have that into the RCA regulations because right now our statutes do not incorporate those, valuation of those services. So you'll see that maybe changed a little bit with an update. And then the environmental benefits is, it's clear. Not only is it allowing more renewable energy integration, but it also may reduce the need for flipping on diesel backup or other fossil fuel peaker plants. And then the value proposition is trying to put that into the governor's task to lower energy costs. But I also think it could also improve the quality of life by spending less income on home energy and promoting economic development. How we get there, strategies and tactics for getting thus. Similar to what we saw in Aurora 1's gather data modeling from existing BESS and ESS demonstration projects, BESS is really becoming tried and proven. There's been a lot of successful models, but we can get into that further with the modeling, how that, maybe more granular is going to affect islanded, stranded communities and the grid. Enabled communities in the coastal communities. For example, maybe because we have Petersburg, Wrangell, and Ketchikan on the SEPA line, maybe, a big battery energy storage system needs to help SEPA in Wrangell since it's in the middle. I don't know, but I think those are the kind of the data and the modeling we can do. That's not only with islanded grid communities, but also perhaps with more robust grid communities in Southeast Alaska. Funding, support local community efforts to access energy improvement in Alaska, include rural or remote through OCD. And I could spell that out, Office of Economic Development. PPP, encourage rural and coastal communities to pursue innovative financing vehicles to attract public-private partnership and investments. Not always do we have public utilities, so we kind of have to put that public-private partnership and investment dynamic in. Alaska Power and Telephone and ALMP are private utilities where most of the other coastal communities are either community-owned or or like SEPA, which is a public action agency. Public facility financing. I think, if there was offers of zero or low interest loans to communities through HFC or related programs for the power and generation install of BESS systems to improve reliability and lower energy costs, I did not research what other states or provinces do for these loans, but there is economic opportunities directly from the Inflation Reduction Act for utilities to invest in battery energy storage systems. So there is public financing available. I just didn't mention the in this version, the Inflation Reduction Act possibilities for financing or for credits. Bulk purchasing, this kind of tail hooks what Robert is saying. If there's a good model or a good system, maybe, and we can't dictate to communities, hey, you must purchase this item, but let's say you buy in bulk. Let's say you're going to buy 10 items for the Marine Highway system, and now some coastal communities want to buy the same system. Maybe there's bulk purchasing opportunities to buy multiple units and issue a contract for a large number of units rather than one. Again, each community may have a specific tailorized need for a BESS or an energy storage system that may or may not work for bulk purchasing, but I just wanted to throw that out because that could be a tactical step. And then workforce training. This is important, and David Burlingame added some comments on there. These things are dangerous. just like I don't know if I would be an advocate of putting a lithium ion on a floating barge or a dock. You also want to make sure that in our coastal communities that we have people trained up on them. They're sensitive pieces of equipment, and they need that training. So I just thought that would be a strategic step, is that it's not just a matter of putting it out into a village or putting it out in a community, but there needs to be some of that training support that comes with that system. And if we can move down to expected results, I just try to capture the expected results. And with careful planning, Alaska can capitalize on BESS systems for cleaner, cheaper, and more resilient power benefiting, and I added this to all because I think that this expands beyond coastal communities. And we've already seen Homer, and we've seen MEA already invest in BESS systems. So they're probably much larger than what the coastal communities will ever do, but there's definitely lessons learned and applicability statewide. So any comments, Robert, or from Michael Baker team?
No, I think it's good. It's very straightforward, very defensible. And I appreciate the fact that you've taken Mr. Burlingame's guidance into account. But at the same time, we always want to keep an eye towards the future. So something that may be too early to incorporate now, I don't mind giving a nod to as we kind of future-proof some of our recommendations as we look forward, because technology changes so rapidly. But again, as I said earlier, I don't think Alaska needs to be first in anything. So this great write-up.
And Mark's not here, and I want to defend Mark because Mark is very interested in a supercapacitor system that's being worked in one of the Arctic villages, and I don't want to throw shade or not throw sunlight onto that, because yes, we should be looking at the technologies, but Robert, I'm kind of agreeing with you, and after listening to David Burlingame, that we want to advocate more tried and proven systems that are up and working right now. And that supercapacitor may work out great, but let's give them an opportunity to succeed.
Right.
You know, I, you know, if someone gets a DOE grant or one of the military installations get a DOE grant or an Arctic Village gets a DOE grant to put in a supercapacitor, I want us as a state to wholly support them in their efforts. But I'm looking at execution and application here and now, I think what you're kind of saying with our current needs. So,
I don't have any substantive comments, but just I did have a clarifying question. I hear it says lower the cost of heating in Alaska. Should that be energy or?
Yeah, I think I might have, put that in there. And it is energy. It could actually lower cost of heating if you have like a large battery energy storage system and you have outages and you have people on electric heating, but, you know, then they're not flipping on their monitors or their wood stoves or other things, but I think energy, that's a good catch.
Okay.
Again, like Robert was working things at 4:30, I was working at these things in different various times of the night and day.
and heat has been a topic of discussion across multiple subcommittees, so I didn't want to just assume.
No, I think capturing energy, it includes heat. I mean, there is heating aspects, but obviously a BESS system is closer related to electrical.
Yeah, but it could be anchoring what's being the system fluctuations for the space heat that happens, you know, heat pumps kicking in, kicking off, you know, those sort of things. So I like energy, using energy, but so when I say energy, it goes back to our very first task force meeting. We wanted to see as much address towards space heat because that's often, you know, half to two-thirds of the energy footprint on its own for Alaskans.
Agree. All right, well, I will try to get an update, and I apologize for giving you an older version, but I was loading them up this morning, and hey, it's all works. Let's go to heat pumps. Now, this one was an earlier.
I believe this is the first one. Right.
Yeah, right. And so this has been shared around. I haven't received direct feedback, although I think that there is some out there. I will point out Michael Baker and our Alaska Energy folks that the heat pump, the European Heat Pump Association, EHPA, I contacted, and they would be willing to work directly with key policymakers with our state. And so I open that door for potential future. Just like people are trying to travel to Iceland and people have gone to Norway, we have an opportunity to work with the European Heat Pump Association, which is kind of like their unified government of all of their countries put together for their technology, their lessons learned, their policy, and other things. That's a sidebar from this. So let's dive into this background. You know, they work down as low as 13 degrees Fahrenheit. And when we say working down, they actually work much lower. But that means that you sometimes have to use supplemental heating. Like you either have to plug in additional electric heat or turn on a monitor stove or throw in some firewood. And that's recognized with the provinces of Northern Canada. Now, Northern Canada is espousing the purchase of systems that go down to -5 Fahrenheit. But they're much more expensive. And so while I was focusing on our coastal regions, I think that we're all pretty good with that 13 Fahrenheit area because we do get colder than that, but it's rare. But as we move to subarctic or Arctic regions, you can actually pay more and buy more robust heat pumps. Your payoff's going to be different because you're going to be investing in more capital, but there is opportunities for more, what I would say, Arctic-friendly heat pumps. They're not the cheap ones, though. Several communities of Alaska are experiencing significant transformation from more expensive fossil fuel heating sources to lower cost heat pumps, saving Alaska households. I was just at the NHA with the KTU executive director, and he is seeing large forecasting in the growth. Now, he has an IRP that's taken through to the public process, but he's reconciling and dealing with that internally. So anecdotally, we don't have the same information in other locations, but I think Andy Romanoff mentioned that they have about 100-unit backlog with construction in Juneau, and it's not abating. So there's a transformation from several data points going forward here in our coastal areas. I meant to ask Clay what he's seeing in Cordova. I know they're out there and they're working on them, but I don't know what his transformation is occurring at his. But I think it's safe to say that there's several communities experiencing significant transformation. Value proposition: how can Alaska and Alaskan communities capture the lessons learned of Northern Europe, Canada, and Maine in ensuring that Alaskans gain from these successes and promote the same opportunities to lower their costs, energy costs, and improve their quality of life by spending less of their income on home heating? Again, this kind of pulls from, we don't need to be the bleeding edge, we just need to know the leading edge and take those lessons learned. And I know that there's provinces in Maine, and there's provinces in Canada and in Efficiency Maine, which is kind of like their Department of Energy, where they're offering low interest loans, they're offering education and advice. They're making sure that contractors are certified so they don't have these installs that are done by, you know, fly-by-night companies that are just haphazardly installing them. I guess what I mean, that they might even have an accreditation. Some of these areas have accreditation programs for installers, you know, making sure that they honor warranties and other things. So I think there's some things we can learn. The value proposition is that we can learn from some of these other places as well. So, I got collaborate internationally. We can partner with the European Heat Association. We can collaborate with the provinces of Canada. And I should add in there our fellow state of Maine. I should have added that too, provinces of Canada. And, I do put Maine on the second one. Collaborate with the Maine State Housing Authority and Efficiency Maine to learn of their programs and adapt and adopt tailored state of Alaska heat pump program with the following suggestions. You know, I don't know all of their programs, and we kind of have to tailor what we exist. So we have an HFC. They have a state housing authority. So there may be applicability, but I would think that our homeowner financing for zero and low interest loans would go through maybe an HFC program and related programs. I know HFC was the agency that handled the energy efficiency upgrade, so seems to me that they would be the likely opportunity here. And then business and public facility financing provides zero interest loans, because I'm looking at beyond just our residents. I mean, if this saves a school and a school's trying to fight like heck to save money and they got a 30-year-old boiler system going out, you know, there's large applicability for commercial size heat pump systems, you know, not only for schools, but government buildings and NGO facilities to adopt heat pumps. So this combined effort, and I'm just going to say any heating expenses for these entities ultimately benefit Alaskans through the lower costs of government operations, lowering multi-unit space heat, or for businesses. E-community heating solutions allocate funds for community district heating projects that utilize heat pumps. Cordova is currently working on that. Sitka is working on that. There's an operation that could happen in Juneau. But if we have community district heating projects, district heating has proven in itself, if you go over to Europe, and I'm sure when Robert was in Norway, when he was staying at hotels, they tend to be on district heating. Europe, it's, in fact, when I traveled over in Europe for district heating, they thought Americans were crazy by having a heating system in each house or each building. They just didn't understand why we're not on district heating. And so I'm not advocating for district heating per se, but I'm saying we need to include district heating, community heating solutions where they may fit. Have AHHC publish and adopt for the use of the fuel, the Juneau Commission on Sustainability Fuel Price Calculator. This calculator was spent months and months to develop. It's very accurate. It kind of took from the DOE and from the Maine and kind of Alaskanized it. So you can take each community's cost of propane, their cost of diesel, their cost of electricity. You can even add the cost of firewood in there. And then you can actually determine, based on the BTU output of your home, what, in fact, you will save by each of these varied costs. So I just throw that out there because it's a resource that's been developed here in Alaska, and it has been used very widely in Southeast Alaska. Bulk purchasing, collaborate with top manufacturers and supply suppliers to buy heat pumps in bulk. Again, with the battery energy storage systems, I have talked to a couple industry reps, and they said, oh, absolutely. If the state of Alaska or a community wanted to buy 100 units, we will definitely mark down and discount the supply. So there's opportunities for bulk purchasing, and that may be something like if AHFC, you know, contracts out and says, hey, we're going to do a loan program, there may be opportunities to buy in bulk. This is no different than communities buying fleet resources or fleet vehicles. You know, if you buy in bulk, you can get a better price. And this may also take out some of the anxiety that, hey, am I buying a tried and proven model? You know, if HFC is buying it in bulk or another entity is buying in bulk, they probably are making sure that it's going to work right and go through those procurement steps to ensure that, you know, the intended receiver is going to get a good product that's going to serve their needs. Workforce training. I know that installing a heat pump takes multiple trades, or it's somebody that's skilled at both of those trades, i.e. electrical. Sometimes you have to rewire the electrical of your building, and then there's a plumbing and heating aspect. And I think we need to have high quality training to ensure high quality heat pump installations. This is one of the things learned that I've read from Efficiency Maine and some of the Canadian provinces, is that, you know, you could have a great program, you could have a great heat pump system, and if it's not installed properly, it doesn't work, and it creates a black eye for the program itself. And so workforce training goes hand in hand with a successful program. Again, I don't know if that would, workforce training would have, I didn't put this in there, but that may be something in the future to say, well, certain contractors are accredited, you know, and HFC approved or community approved for, you know, that they'll stand behind their warranty and that they do a good job of workmanship. Public education, partner with Alaska nonprofits such as Alaska Heat Smart and tribal organizations. with heat pump programs to educate the public about heat pump benefits. This includes offering building assessments for heat pump suitability and providing unbiased advice and recommendations. I like the idea of partnering with Alaska nonprofits because then it's not an industry representative coming or a utility representative coming and trying to sell you a specific program, but it's a little bit more unbiased. That again, that public education and outreach can also, you know, be incorporated with our state agencies like AEA and AHSC as well. And then utility billing integration. Obtain RCA authorization allowing electrical utilities to introduce on-bill financing. This lets Alaskans conveniently pay off their heat pump loans directly through their utility bills, streamlining the repayment process for consumers and AHSC alike. So there's a large percentage of our Alaskans that live paycheck to paycheck. They don't have an extra $2,000 or $3,000 laying around or $5,000 to go out and buy an air source heat pump, even though it may save them $200 or $300 a month, and the savings thereof could pay for that capital investment. This is where loaning program comes in and utility billing integration comes on, where that is actually tacked on, that capital payment or a portion of that capital payment is actually tacked on to your utility bill. This is highly successfully used in other jurisdictions. In fact, if you get a USDA loan today from the Department of Agriculture, from the Rural Utility Services, one of the requirements in order to get a USDA RUS loan is to show that a utility must show their on-billing financing program. So this is a way of the future, whether we like it or not, whether utilities like it or not, or whether, and I know from the utility side, and I don't want to have any sacred cows here, it can be a pain in the ass. When you're collecting money for an HFC program, you know, that is now an assigned responsibility that's been transferred to that utility provider. It may not necessarily be welcomed with open arms. Nonetheless, I think it's all resolvable. And those admin costs obviously shouldn't be borne by the utility. Someone's going to have to administer the program. And I think therein lies the issue is making sure that it's a win-win. That's the Sitka energy director calling me, but I'm tied up, so I have to get back with him. RPACE, residential property assessed clean energy. So consider state adoption of streamlined, easy for consumer RPACE program. An RPACE program is like a CPACE program where the loan is anchored to your property. It's no longer anchored to your own personal credit rating. What this does is allows low-income folks to buy and purchase based on the value of their property value. And so if you have bad credit, or even if you have good credit, it's a way for you to get essentially an on-bill financing mechanism like under J, but it's through your property assessment locally. So it's an opportunity to allow a financing mechanism for air source heat pumps or heat pumps in general. Now, we talk about a single head system of an air source heat pump. When I say a single head system, if you visualize one of those fan units of an air conditioner system, and then you have a single head inside your home, which is a one distribution unit. That's fine for open homes, and it's fine for small homes, and it's also fine to supplement if you've got another heating system in your home. But if you're going to do multifamily or you're going to do a three-story home, you may want to now start investing in systems that are $10,000 or $15,000 or $20,000 or $25,000. And now we're getting into a larger investment, and you know, our pace and on-bill financing, utility billing integration can in fact help in some of those financing pursuits. Federal support, pursue federal aid and funding to bolster state of Alaska initiatives and community projects. I'm also going to include, there's all kinds of tribal energy monies. So in Southeast Alaska, but also, or coastal Alaska, but also in other places where tribal entities exist. And I want to add this into the federal support because I failed to add tribal opportunities. Sometimes tribal opportunities are only available to tribal residents, but in many times the federal program will also say, well, this is in a tribal community, so you also need to open this up for non-tribal members. That's up to the tribes of how they determine to do all that, but I just think that this could also help with the widespread adoption and utilization of heat pumps while reducing energy costs. So the implementation timeline, this action has a blend of immediate and short-term tasks for implementation. There's things we can do now. There's things that are going to be short-term. And I also think that, you know, if you wanted to say recalibration, evaluations of systems, let's say HFC implemented a system for 3 years, and they may want to evaluate it after 3 years, it could have, you know, longer-term recalibrations evaluations to, you know, maybe make the project or make the programs smarter, wiser, and better in the future. So the expected results, the state of Alaska with careful and planned execution can advance and promote heat pump technology systems. And I put all of the systems, and I can spell those out, but they're air source heat pump, seawater heat pump, and ground source heat pump. And we probably should spell those out so the public understands what those acronyms are. As alternative energy resource in coastal Alaska that is tried and proven in other Arctic, subarctic, and temperate locations. The expected results will lower Alaskans' heating costs and reduce the dependency on imported fuels, creating demand for the development of local energy resources to displace imported fuels. And then the structured execution list offers a clear roadmap of the proposed steps to promote the adoption of heat pumps in Alaska to lower the cost of heating in Alaska. Any comments from Robert as the co-chair, and then I'd open it up to the rest of the folks, AEA and Michael Baker.
Yes, pretty straightforward. I think spelling out some of those acronyms is going to be good to help us understand, but pretty straightforward.
We'll do that as part of our technical editing too with all the subcommittees.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like I threw in USDOE. I mean, to me, USDOE is kind of like, you know, known, but we should probably not assume the public is always going to know what we're talking about when we're dealing with energy issues. And then we can always, you know, use parentheses after, but at least we've spelled out the acronym in the first use.
Okay.
Well, Audrey, while you got that up there, I wanted to ask Audrey, and I didn't mean to put her on the spot, but, you know, there's a lot of, and, you know, we don't have a member from AHFC on the line, but there's a lot of overlap or possible overlap with AEA. You got any comments from you? And I don't know if Curtis is still on the line. You know, thoughts, how we could improve, or maybe are we going on the wrong track? Because some of this is going to obviously have AHFC. To me, it's just common sense that we're going to have to direct some of this to AEA and AHFC. So I just like, I'm not going to hold you to it, Audrey. I just would love to have the value of your knowledge and your perspective.
Yeah, I think this document is pretty straightforward. And, you know, when it comes to commercial and residential heating, you know, AHFC, typically they deal with residential. But if we are we have a really good working relationship with them. And so if we receive funding that maybe that's more in their wheelhouse, we reach out to them and, you know, work with them and pass it on, and they do the same. So if it's not identified clearly in here, just know that, you know, if they move forward or a project moves forward, we work pretty closely with them and figure out who's doing what, who's more, which what is the project and who's wheelhouse? Yeah.
No, that's good to understand. I kind of understood in the background that HFC is more residential property oriented, but we're going to want to make sure that schools, you know, everybody knows schools costs go up, and if you're spending more for heat, that's less to spend on teachers or educating your kids. So, you know, we want to make sure that we have a wide spectrum of opportunity, and HFC is more residential centric. So that's good. You know, we'll have to figure out whose wheelhouse or how do we marriage programs together if this goes forward.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Michael, any of your team?
I don't think so. I mean, you've been very comprehensive, and the subject matter experts on the call have said it's pretty straightforward, so.
Well, agreed. We always want to calibrate and get more, because what Pat always said, a plan works really well until the first bullets fly, and we haven't shared this with the public, so, you know. I would also offer this. Because we're under time constraints and timelines, if there is suggested comments from anybody on the line later of how to improve or how to, you know, hey, what about this? And maybe you don't have a specific, maybe you, hey, what about an area we're missing? Not only on this, but on any other ones. I think that would be, wise for the order to hear. So I want to make this as collaborative and also give an open door for everybody. I did that with Mark on the BEST system. So, you know, I mean, and he was extremely helpful, being a subject matter expert or, engineer in that matter. So. Just want to offer that. All right, it is now 11:30. Let's tackle one more, and then we're going to have to take a break if we can. So,
you get your roller shoes on, I bet you could do them all.
I don't know. I don't know.
I think rather than going through, you know, maybe pull each one up and go just to the higher benefits, and you do the first and last paragraph and have introduced there. It's really just to get it onto the record, and then we can encourage folks to provide comments, after that. But it's just good to pull each one up, identify its task, the action item, and then what its benefit is.
Okay. So,
this is what I pulled up earlier.
Yeah, net metering. So, net metering, and I did not pull up, and I could put this in the background. Net metering, for everybody that's aware, net metering is an energy framework of tariffs and regulations for Alaska's diverse stakeholders to promote net metering investments and provide grid resiliency and energy security and lower the costs, energy costs for Alaskans. So net metering is used almost in every state. Alaska's probably on the lower end or the lowest end in many areas. When I say lowest end, we have very low limits of what you can put back into the system. But net metering, the background is it's a billing arrangement for owners of renewable energy systems. And so excess electricity generated by a customer, whether it's a school or whether it's a residence, and in Alaska it's only residences, not businesses per se, or businesses can, but they're under very low sellbacks to the utility, is sent back to the utility grid, offsetting the electricity the customer draws from the grid when their system isn't producing electricity. So you're basically a mini generation system, whether it's a little windmill in the back of your house or field, or it's the solar on your roof. So net metering of private energy systems plays an integral role in the ongoing transition to more sustainable, flexible power grids, but also reducing the lower cost of power. You know, in the rail belt, they're finding that, you know, it's nice to have a portfolio of different generation and assets rather than have all your eggs in one basket. In our coastal region, it's similar. We have a lot of hydropower, but this offers, you know, net metering offers the opportunity for businesses, schools, municipal governments, tribes, residents to invest in smaller renewable energy systems, reduce their costs. I think I saw Bear Creek Winery and the Kenai, they use a solar system to help chill their wine, and then they're able to reduce their costs by hundreds of thousands of dollars and then sell back what they can to the grid. So there is value in this, clearly. Value proposition. An advanced net metering statutory and regulatory framework for Alaskans can optimize mutually beneficial benefits and act as a linchpin for sustainable, resilient, and economically advantageous energy future, not only in the island and grids, but also in interconnected transmission grids. It helps diversify the energy portfolio and invigorates and sustains public and private investment. It provides energy security and grid resiliency while lowering the energy costs for Alaskans. And so how do we get there? You know, investigate, evaluate, recommend, and update, modify changes to Alaska's net metering laws and regulations for best management practices based on other successful state metering programs. So each state has its own rules, regulations. There's obviously some that are progressive, some that are not progressive. I think I was reading in New Jersey, and I'm not going to quote it, but they allow up to 3 megawatts for community net metering. So if a school system puts solar roofs on all their schools, they're allowed to sell up to 3 megawatts back to the utility or back to the grid. Now, that may or may not be something we do, but I'm just saying there's a spectrum from the 25 kilowatts that we limit to 3 megawatts. That's quite a huge divide. And where the right number is, I think it needs to be evaluated. Encourage AEA, HFC, Denali Commission, and other agencies to assist in finance community, tribal, and business and residential net metering investments to improve grid. And then I think there's a policy framework of the regulation. We need to have, through the governor's office, AEA, RCA, a clear and supportive regulatory framework that invigorates and favors net metering. If we're going to lower the cost of power, I think this is essential, so that we have vigorous net metering models and best management practices. And then we also have to provide the resources, the leadership and agency assignments and oversight to ensure that the resulting regulatory framework provides long-term clarity and certainty to private public investors, community energy security and utilities. So what we did when we passed our last law was it got passed and we kind of put it on the shelves, but it was a laissez-faire for the utilities to execute, implement, come up with their own rules and whatever. And I think we need to have some policy framework and some hand-holding and guidance and leadership like other states use. So it's not just a regulation on the books, but it's more of a combined and collaborative effort. And since RCA is a component, the governor's office is going to be a component to lower the cost of energy with AEA, and obviously utilities are going to have some say in how this works. You know, I think this needs to be a policy framework that is directive rather than aspirational, even though I didn't use those words in there. Infrastructure development, invest and finance grid infrastructure for residential, business, community renewables, grid distribution systems. Again, I did include tribal here, but HFCA, ADA, tribal, and federal funding to facilitate grid interconnectivity for renewable energy sources. I will say that there's also, I didn't include this, IRS tax incentives for homeowners and others to invest in solar arrays and wind farm for their community or for their residential. So there's also some tax incentive pieces there. And then develop and promote energy storage systems like we discussed for the battery energy storage system. So let's say you have a small village in Southeast Alaska, one of the coastals, and let's say a tribe gets a $8 million grant to put a solar roof on every tribal house in the entire village. That's great, but the sun comes up and the sun goes down, and then how do you store that, you know, in the off-peak or off-day hours? And so, you know, are these home energy battery storage systems, or are these going to be utility battery energy storage systems? I'm not a really throwing that out, but I'm just saying, such as battery energy storage systems to address the intermittent nature of the community and residential renewable energy sources like wind and solar. Robert, I don't know if that's you. We got some bleed in from the background. There might be some talking in the background.
I've got staff that's trying to put together an annual meeting next week, so I'll keep my mic off.
Okay, and by all means, turn it back on when you got comments to throw in there. So the incentivization, which is a long word that I'm trying to spit out, financial support, I think there needs to be a breadbasket of incentives that we can look at from different agencies. And then we got outreach and stakeholder collaboration. You could scroll down a little bit, Michael. And this also includes partnering. Keep going up. I mean, I'm still on the with university systems. I think there's a role to utilities and partner with university systems, you know, NGOs, you know, like Alaska Heat Smart and others, boroughs and city governments. And I also add in there that, you know, these net metering systems or these small micro generator systems also help with some of Governor Dunleavy's perspectives that we need to be resilient for natural disasters. So I added that benefit in there, even though we're looking at lowering the cost of power, because net metering systems do help our community resiliency for natural disasters. If you're on a dialysis, home dialysis machine, and your neighbor has a solar array with a battery and net metering system, and you need to be plugged in to operate that, you know, that's a community asset that helps that individual get through that natural disaster. And then technology and innovation, I'll just go through, I mean, we can just say there's research and development, monitoring and feedback mechanisms. I'll just add on there that publish annual reports so that we can calibrate. So it's not just a report for report's sake, but how do we make this better, faster, smarter as we advance programs? The implementation timeline, I think this is the full spectrum of from immediate to long-term. And then we have a net metering roadmap. For the expected results, you know, I think this can play Alaska because of our diverse needs and our diverse communities and whatnot. This could put Alaska a pinnacle of energy innovation and leadership while empowering net metering participants in our state utilities to collaboratively. This doesn't have to be a zero-sum game. This is a win-win collaborating effort to advance the state's net metering in Alaska as a public interest good. The strategy and tactics empower Alaskans to amplify private and public investments. Whenever we can invest public and private investments, we're helping lower that cost of power. We're fortifying grid stability. Embracing this action, I am Alaska is assisting net metering Alaska demands and security while ensuring net metering advances are addressed collaboratively, openly, transparently, sustainably, and economically, ensuring a sustainable and cost-effective energy future that reduces the energy costs for Alaskans. we know that this, through the legislative process, this was a sausage-making process, I'll call it, to get to where we're at. And that's why I really am emphasizing collaboratively, openly, transparently, sustainably, and economically. So it incorporates all the public interest viewpoints as we develop a more robust net metering system for Alaska. So, Robert, go ahead, hit your mic off. I'd love to hear your thoughts, and then we'll share around.
Thank you for your discussion. We're going to provide, we're going to get paint the surface viewpoints on this. I think whatever we can do to move forward, I mean, it is obvious to see the benefits this type of investment can make for ratepayers in Alaska. So it's just stick it out there and see what we do for consideration and input.
Great, thank you. Yeah, and I think I use the word sausage making process when the easy action items that the task force making are less of a sausage making process or are less ingredients, and the more complicated ones where net metering is, we'll probably have it'll take legislation, it'll take hearings, it'll take public input. So it's just the natural course of implementing policy. Audrey, I'd like to just turn it over to you, not put you to speak on behalf of AEA, but your viewpoints and understandings of where this could be and your thoughts on this.
I haven't been involved in the task force, but I'm wondering, this seems like it would apply to all the different subcommittees. Do you know if they've been discussing this and would they all mesh together, or?
That's a good question. Go ahead. Finish your,
I was just going to say someone might be able to provide more insight that's been involved with all the different subcommittees.
You bring out a really good point. I know in our past discussions that we've said, well, we're not going to, if there's a good idea in another committee, it's not, it'll be looked at, and there could be applicability of other committee items. I think net metering is not going to be just a coastal, to your point, I don't think it's just a coastal community situation. It's actually statewide, and so I think this needs to be, This particular one would actually have some gravity to be rolled up in other committees for their input and discussion as we go from coastal, like a Russian nested owl. Maybe this started in the coastal, but it has applicability on more of a statewide potential. Not only would it help coastal, but it would also help maybe other areas and regions. Michael, your thoughts on that particular point that Audrey raised?
So we do kind of raise, we do look at these actions at a task force level. We have the subcommittees kind of report out. But then also, I just wanted to highlight, we did launch a new survey this week where we're kind of looking at the high level, kind of how we're going to evaluate and prioritize actions across all subcommittees, not just, your own subcommittee's prioritization. And part of that, we're kind of looking at, certain metrics, alignment with the region. So if you have an action that you're going to check off the box, hey, it aligns with all the regions, maybe that, is a higher level action. And I think that's going to be a discussion of where those live in the final report. But I think that's part of the next step is we're going to start evaluating all these actions as one task force.
Well, I think you've given us a good answer to both Audrey's question and in my understanding, too. It also points out that I'm deficient in answering the survey. When does that do, by the way?
As long as it's like, the Monday before this Monday. So noon on Monday.
Okay, thank you.
It's only three questions. So.
No, I got it, but there's a lot of checkoffs, so gotta read the full question.
Yeah.
Well, Michael, aside from Andre's question on the role of applicability, which is a very good point and question comment, any of your team's thoughts on this or how to calibrate, make it better, or other aspects?
So one of the things when we start looking at all of the subcommittees, I think you've provided a lot more depth and detail than other subcommittees may be formulating at this point. So I think just for consistency, when we start finalizing the final report, having that discussion, do we want, for it to be, for each subcommittee section of the report, do we want the formatting to be consistent, or do we just want all of the information that was produced to be in the executive summary, or do we want to pull back and have some in an appendix? And I think that's more of an administrative formatting question, but it is important in terms of messaging to the public and what's in the final document.
No, I agree. I think that's a real good discussion to have with the Curtises and the Clays and the Lieutenant Governors of how,
yeah,
them as the chairs are going to want to present this to the public.
And until we have that kind of draft formatted, where it's probably premature to have that discussion.
Absolutely. And I mean, hopefully someone will see what we're doing here and say, hey, we got to pick up our game or add more, or we can spur on that discussion points with other committees to produce more robust recommendations to the public and to the governor. I hate to do this, but this is a breaking point for me, only so I can then have my I can be thinking about all kinds of action items while I'm sitting in the dentist chair, trying to avoid well, you guys know what I'm talking about.
May the laughing gas bring you joy. And what we can do is, Michael, after Duff leaves, why don't we just bring up each one of the remaining ones for the record, and we'll just take a look at that, and that way they'll all have been entered in for a public discussion, and then we can adjourn from there.
Okay. Yeah, and I would just add in there, I was thinking that since we had a couple more, we have at least two more, don't we, Michael, or do we have one? Two more?
Just go. Yeah.
Let's bring them up for the record, but I'm willing to meet for a half hour or so this afternoon if necessary, to cover them on the public record. But we could just bring them up for now, just to say that they're entered.
It's your choice for me to do it now without you, or you to do it without me at two. How's that?
I kind of wrote them up, so I feel almost like I need to, but I don't want to. I don't want
to.
But let's bring them up. So we got transmission, funding, and execution, and hydropower.
If they're at all consistent with the other ones, they're well written and fairly self-explanatory. So if you want to have the 2 o'clock and go through them for the record, great. I'll try to participate, but I do have an annual meeting getting away from me.
No, I know. I mean, I hear you.
So,
I hear you. We're good people are always busy.
Yeah, that's the transmission one. It looks like, is this the most recent one or?
No, that's a bolo. That's a bolo. Okay. That's probably an example. So pull up the hydropower, and okay, we will have at the 2 o'clock the one that looks like this for hydropower. So that was let me just make that for my notes so I get that corrected. That was
the transmission.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Must have loaded up the wrong document. Okay, so hydropower development. I just want to enter it into the record. Robert hasn't had time to look at this, but Alaska is really blessed with hydropower. And I think our region is really blessed with hydropower. It was real clear from the National Hydropower Association's meeting that took place this week in Anchorage that a clear national focus is on developing. We're one of the last bastions of undeveloped hydropower in the nation. One thing that I didn't put in here, and I kind of want to just broach it, and I think we need to put this in here, is that hydropower kind of includes the genre, I would say, under DOE with now hydrokinetic and tidal. It's kind of falling in that sphere, but I didn't want to throw that out here without Robert's or other people's thinking, because one, you dilute hydropower, and two, it's also where things are going, and so it's kind of a jump ball, but I think we should also include those resources. Even though they're not fully developed, they're developing. What's your thoughts on that, Robert?
Yeah, no, we need to, because we can't have such a volume of individualized recommendations. We have to have some, conglomeration, and so this is not supposed to be exclusive, it's supposed to be inclusive. So, right now we've got more and more interest in wave and tidal and in river systems. So, the whole hydrokinetic aspect of hydropower, it should be acknowledged. This is a higher level. What the governor does with the task group, going after this, hopefully we'll continue to work and we can refine and differentiate later, but I like to see it included here as much as possible.
So let's add tidal and hydrokinetic. One of the discriminating factors I want to add, though, is that even though we're trying to be generic, is executable. And executable is a differentiation between dream, design, research, and now you have a market. And that's what I see, whether it's hydropower, tidal, or hydrokinetic. I don't want us to go on rabbit chases of technology pursuits that may not have the technology ready to execute now, but that doesn't mean we don't think about it. But it's not deployable. It kind of goes back to my discussion with David Burlingame. We don't want to be the guinea pig. I'd rather have us have 18 tidal operations in Oregon and Maine and then put the one in Angoon or Hoonah so that they don't get stuck with, hey, it doesn't work except for certain days of the year. So that being said, I do agree with you. I just want to put the collar on there of tidal or hydrokinetic, that we use the collar or the sideboards of executable, and we can expand this from hydropower, if that works for you. Okay. Well, guys, with that, let's table our discussions here. It's 11:52. Gives me enough time to get to the dentist. we'll be back at 2 o'clock. And Michael, I don't know if you're going to be jumping in with the incentives and subsidies, but I'm going to try to catch them for a little bit before the 2 o'clock readjournment.
I'll be on that meeting as well.
Yeah, and Robert, we'll try to go through this quickly so we're not tying. I know you're busy getting the Southeast Conference ship shape.
Hey, give your dentist a message for me. Drill, baby, drill.
You got a message from who?
For your dentist.
Oh, thanks, man. All right. We'll see you guys.
Okay.
Can see it too.
Bye. There we are.
At last, where I am. I'm finally with all of you guys. I'm sorry I hit the link from this morning's agenda and put me in a waiting room.
Yeah, we're good. We talked to Karin too, who helps schedule meetings with Malia, and we have a workaround for that to avoid that in the future. So.
Yeah, no problem. It's all good. Hey, thanks for everybody. I want to value your time, so I really apologize being a couple minutes late. We just literally, many of you were on the same meeting with the incentives and subsidies committee. Michael, with no further ado, if you could pull up where we left off, if we can go into that hydropower, and I think we just had there was one other after that, and we'll finish off so that we have it on the public record. So I'll redraft this with the understanding that the hydropower industry now includes tidal and hydrokinetic. I think the differentiator is we're going to support them all, but, you know, where we really support is the ones that got all their permits, they got their financing in place, they got their markets and whatever, so that we're not going on rabbit chases or we're diluting those that are real projects versus those that are dream. 29% of Alaska's hydro or electricity is hydro. It could be a lot more, but we are a very hydropower state, and I think where hydropower assets exist, it's going to always continue. And let's just call it like we see it. Hydropower is the lowest cost power in the state right now. I mean, I hear nuclear can get cheaper, but it's not built, so I don't know. The value proposition, if you can move down the value proposition. One thing that's real important to factor in is that we're still getting hydropower off of, we're still getting benefits off of hydropower built 100 years ago, which is a longer life cycle than other factors. So that's a good value proposition. You do an investment today, it gets paid off in 20 years. You're basically getting the power for free for 80 years, except for the operations, maintenance, and upkeep. How to get there? Let's go down a little bit. Scroll down.
Tell me when to stop.
Just go to the top of the how we get there.
Oh, at the top that thing.
How we get there, yeah. Look at what we did for Bribe the Lake and the Four Dam Pool. I mean, the key answer is they were heavily subsidized, but Wrangell, Ketchikan, and Petersburg likes their 6-cent power. Juneau likes its 3-cent power from Snettisham, and Bradley Lake really underpins the lower cost component out of most of the Rail Belt Utilities portfolio. I also think that there's some prudent business practices that we could investigate from BC Hydro. I noticed that this morning Black and Beach wasn't online, but that's something that I would like them to add into this. BC Hydro, the British Columbia government owns the utility system. They also have a transmission corporation called BCTC, and there might be some modeling that we get with how they've invested in private and public ventures on hydropower to keep their costs low. Provide AEA the authority to identify, invest in regional hydropower and recent hydropower transmission and distribution assets for the public benefit. I'm looking at this as Wautauna, and or is there other regions or coastal areas where there needs to be state investment for the long-term development of lower cost power, not just now, but for the next 50 years. Encourage utilities to financially participate in the ownership and long-term offtake arrangements to provide energy security and growth, and also to service new large loads. Combine federal tax incentives with grants, loans, and agreements to cover the cost over the long term. Right now, there's frickin' huge amount of money that is now available to hydropower that wasn't available before. It used to only be available to solar and wind, so there's a lot of new opportunities. Establish the State of Alaska Power Fund to own and operate Alaska hydropower assets that can provide regional benefits. Maybe this is something that just outgrows from what's already existing. I don't think we're going to build Wautauna, and I don't think we're going to build some of the major ones without some state power fund or with some Alaska involvement. So I just want to throw that out there. Establish a State of Alaska administered and supervised investment mechanisms for equity ownership for utility, tribal, local community investments to get some local buy-in and pay-in combining local equity with federal financing through existing or new federal programs. Seek federal legislation to provide the funding for a State of Alaska Power Fund. And I think some of the tie-in is also with the DOD and Energy Security for America and Alaska for our military and Coast Guard operations. Identify and support and fund regional hydropower to support Alaska communities with multiple transmission interconnected communities at economy scale to provide lower cost power. Again, Ketchikan and Wrangell and Petersburg sure proved the value of being intertied together where they were able to move power around so that they weren't, Ketchikan wasn't chugging on super expensive diesel. They still were on diesel, but they were able to offset during droughts. Identify, seek, and support the construction of hydropower assets to export power to provide economies of scale. Develop intertie connections strategically, placing transmission to interconnect with current and future transmission to provide transmission corridors to known and undeveloped hydropower locations. In other words, there's crown jewels that Clay has in his area. There's crown jewels in the Kenai and other coastal areas. There's key projects in Southeast Alaska, but they will never, ever be economically viable unless someone locates a transmission line somewhere close or near them. And so, therefore, that can be a consideration in transmission planning so that it intercepts or allows for a close interconnection for some of this. And, Michael, if you could scroll down further because I've read down to that end. Establish no, you went down too far. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I slipped.
Establish federal, state federal power board through congressional legislation to comply, have the federal government landowners actively assist state of Alaska in developing hydropower assets on federal lands. This is really critically important in, the coastal, areas, but it's also just as important maybe in other regions of the state. There's could be more effort where we're not just sitting across a big long table and then the lawsuits are filed, but how could we create a working group and even have federal or congressional legislation to help us have more of a cooperative relationship with USDA and DOI. And then review, refine, and amend Section 4245.350. Most people in Alaska don't realize this, but we already have licensing for water development projects. It's just that it's never been funded. It was actually drafted by Representative Lisa Murkowski in past. So I'd like to bring that up because this underneath the right circumstances could provide a faster hydropower permitting, abbreviated regulatory permitting schedule. But it also, with the revamping of that review and refine, we could also increase Alaska interdepartmental coordination to support hydropower projects.
Is Mark?
Yeah.
Is Robert? Yeah, Robert on. I think that sure looks like one that would be good for statutes and regulations to take up.
Yeah, send it over to us.
Okay. And that's good that we're identifying roll-ups where it could have, larger statewide implications or other regions' implications. And this would be another one. Work with congressional delegation to ensure that FERC-exempt and state-licensed hydro projects qualify for all eligible federal production tax credits and investment tax credits. I'm here to tell people that if you don't have a FERC-licensed project, you're not eligible for certain credits, and it's entirely unfair for the small developers in Alaska that get a FERC exemption or get a future state-licensed hydropower project, and yet you do not receive those credits. And so we have to bridge that gap. And that helps financing for hydropower and helps communities develop hydropower. So an implementation timeline, I think this has immediate to, for execution ready hydropower and short term, midterm for tasks, you know, for that need more analysis or in different developmental stages. And then the expected results that the state of Alaska can take an active, willful, calculated role in lowering the cost, energy costs for Alaskans, energy security and economic prosperity by effectively guiding hydropower investments and hydropower assets and related transmission and distribution infrastructure. So we can pencil on this more. I just wanted to throw this into the public record. And if we could move it, I'm sorry, Robert, I know I'm trying to rush things just in preservation of your time, but let me turn this back over to you for comment.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to object to moving forward. I mean, there's a number of things in there that are, I think, very long range. That's going to be way outside the scope of what we can do in the near term, but including building liabilities and hoping in the hopes that assets can be built. But no, let's just move forward. I have no objection.
Okay, thanks. Appreciate it. Any comment from Andre or Mark or anyone else on the line?
No, I don't have anything to add. Thank you.
All right, and moving right along. Michael, I think we have one more that's been drafted.
Which one? Just remind me.
That is transmission funding and execution, I believe.
Did you send an update to that? Because
Shoot. No, I did not. Went to the dentist. I did not.
Okay. We can talk about it high level if you want.
Curious, we just got through talking about a bunch of transmission. Is that a separate one or going to be melded together?
It's a separate one. And I'm trying to find it. I kind of put them all in a nice little boxes and things with an AESTF folder, but it might have been somehow. Yeah, it's definitely separate. At least how I've drafted it. Let's see if this pulls up. Nope. Where is it coming? Computer's thinking. Yeah, so let me see if I can send this off real quick. I hate to not have myself work.
I'll just
verbalize it. There you go. Okay, so task and purpose would be to target federal funding and implement financing to build and expand transmission and distribution lines in Alaska to lower cost, energy costs for Alaskans, increase energy security, and power Alaska's future. Background. Despite its vastness covering 17.5% of the U.S. land mass, Alaska's transmission systems is strikingly underdeveloped. With only 1,697 miles of high and low voltage transmission lines, it represents less than 0.25% of the nation's total transmission infrastructure. To put this in perspective, the contiguous U.S. boasts over 700,000 circuitous miles of these lines. Furthermore, Puerto Rico, U.S. territory, is 2,478 miles, while Wyoming, a state with its population size comparable to Alaska, is 4,300. This subpar transmission network hampers the integration of renewable energy resources and poses challenges for military installations in ensuring transmission contingencies to support critical national security missions. Moreover, there is an urgent need for congressional funding action. For example, despite having congressional authorization of $384 million for the Southeast Intertie, which aims to connect Metlakatla to Skagway, the promised funds have not been authorized. Alaska's grid modernization is just not about powering homes and lowering costs. It's crucial for national security, economic growth, and future energy resilience that Alaskans deserve. Regardless of any metric, stating that there is a transmission need in Alaska is an understatement. We saw and heard earlier, and I'll just comment on that, we saw and heard earlier from Brian Hickey that I think the rail belt needs $2.9 billion. Well, I think Coastal has its needs. I'm sure the distribution needs in our rural ports of Alaska are important, but this is coming from a Coastal perspective, since there is a particular public law 105611, if I'm quoting it right, where there's an authorization out there. Value proposition. Alaska must upgrade its outdated territorial grid system to a modern 21st century standard incorporating N1 contingencies. This transformation is crucial for integrating renewables and other new energy resources, bringing Alaska on par with the rest of the nation with the first world transmission grid will reduce energy costs and enhance energy security, laying a self-reliant solid energy foundation for Alaska's future. How we get there. Develop and create a State of Alaska Transmission Fund under ADA to promote, secure, and establish federal authorization and appropriations funding for the development of additional 3,000 miles of transmission corridor for Alaska to move Alaska from pre-territorial grid system to a grid system that ignites development, integrates renewables, displaces more expensive diesel generation, reducing energy costs. Create a system that allows ADA, AEA, and federal funding to develop, design, build, execute, and operate additional regional transmission sections and links under a unified plan. Implementation timeline. This action has a blend of immediate and short-term tasks for implementation. Expected results. Alaska must exponentially increase its haphazard and subgrade transmission system if Alaska is developed and maintain its economic viability. Federal funding for a State of Alaska Power Transmission Fund to state and Alaska Power Transmission Fund will enable the state to develop other state energy plan action items. Creating a robust transmission network in the Rail Belt coastal areas is essential for Alaska to prosper economically. And then just this structure execution list to develop the State of Alaska Power Transmission Fund offers a clear roadmap for the proposed steps to promote the action to lower the energy cost of Alaskans while providing means and funding to transform the dire transmission situation as it exists within Alaska today. So you can see it's a very pro-transmission action item. So I'll take any comments. I'll just say that when my personal discussions with Senator Sullivan, who's pretty much aghast that we were 0.25% of the nation's transmission grid. He likes to say, well, Connecticut's got more roads than Alaska. He's now using this. And there was comments made on the DOE National Transmission Needs Study where, frankly, they didn't even put Alaska in there until IBW, AEA, Juneau Hydropower, and other people complained and got the congressional delegation to weigh in. It's seriously a inability for us to go forward in the state unless we have transmission improvements. I used a 3,000-mile increase rather than a dollar amount because I think that's the goal. It's not the dollar spent. It's what we need. And that would include connecting eventually Copper Valley Electric. It would eventually hit Valdez and Glen Allen. It would robustly impact and improve the rail belt grids. It would also potentially lay lines to from Fairbanks down that mine that's trying to be created out there. The highway that they're looking at, as well as the Southeast Intertie. So I do think that even though it's coming from a coastal perspective, it has statewide applicability. And frankly, if you have a congested power line anywhere in the state and you develop a 15-megawatt or a 1,500-megawatt solar farm, if you can't get it on the grid, it's worthless. It won't achieve what it needs. So I see generation and transmission go hand in hand, so I drafted it up that way. So I just sorry for not having this sent out to you guys for actual reading. I'll send it to us. I'll send it out right after this meeting here, but, you know, so I apologize for that. Robert, your comments or anyone else's comments, and I appreciate the fact that you're not able to look at it in front of you. It's pretty much done verbalization and a read over.
That's fine. But, you know, I just want to make sure that we insert the word economically viable for all these, for any infrastructure that's built. So we don't want to leave a stranded, you know, liability hanging out there for ratepayers to pick up. So. But,
I agree with you by not having the ratepayers pick it up, but I don't agree with you if it means that the federal government pays for a line that lowers the cost of power. I'm going to be gladfully and willfully taking that money. Just like happened in Kansas and Missouri during the 1936 Rural Electrification Act, the federal government paid millions of dollars to hook up little towns of 100 people, and there was no economic viability about it at all. But, to your point, it didn't go against their rates either.
Yep. No, if it's lowering the cost of energy, I'm on board.
Cool. Audrey, I know I mentioned AEA would be having some leadership hands in this. You got any comments? Off the top?
No, not off the top, but I think I'm sure it'll be discussed more a little later as it moves along.
Right. And Michael or Malia, any comments? And I know, Michael, you're burning out from meeting after meeting after meeting for nonstop. You're on a torture tour, but any comments?
No, I mean, this is great follow-up from the meeting this morning, so I think we just wanted to capture these last two just for the record. So this is our overflow meeting.
Yeah, and we did not complete all the action items. I will try to, in addition to the ones that I've committed to with the Incentives and Subsidies Committee, I'll try to draft up what's remaining there or what I can, and we'll just take it from there. When is our next meeting scheduled, Michael, if you could help me with, I switched offices today, so I don't have my notes in front of me from my other office.
So as a subcommittee, there's going to be a chance to meet at the task force meeting, and you'll be given the option to kind of continue focusing on kind of building out this or looking at the kind of the prioritization results from the survey and applying them to your actions, but there's flexibility with how you want to use that time.
Great, great. And Robert, are you going to be able to attend? I know you have a conference in Sitka, I think, at the same time.
I have no way in the world going to be doing anything but facilitating 80 speakers over 3 days next week. That's my only focus.
No, I figured as much, but I figured I'd get you to see if you were going to squeeze out something or turn that over to an assistant. But, yes. So, Michael, I'm not flying to Anchorage this time. I got contractors coming in this week, and I have, like I think I put on email, I have to moderate a candidate questionnaire and answer period for our local elected officials, so I couldn't fly back in time. And Robert, I'm sorry, I'm not attending the Southeast Conference. I really want to be there, but I'm being pulled as well.
Okay. And for the breakout session, we might have Malia kind of lead that too. So that's why she's been part of all these calls.
Right. Well, I'm gonna hope that our committee is like ahead of the curve rather than behind it. Because Robert's not going to be there. I need to represent him well. we'll hopefully do well. Do good, not in comparison, but just to move the whole task force action items forward.
Mm-hmm. No, I think you're in a great place.
Okay. Robert, you got any words of wisdom? I'm going to turn you back over. Sure. We took a half hour. I appreciate your flexibility of adding on time here.
no, it's going to get it moved forward, especially since, as soon as they called out the 19th for the date, I let it be known that I was not available for that day. So, glad staff can move it forward, and we'll go from there.
Cool. Well, guys, we'll turn over your afternoon back to you. Thank you, Audrey. Thank you, Malia. Thank you, Michael. And we'll catch you on Tuesday. I will send out some task force or some of these task and purpose sheets for additional items. And before I forget, as soon as we get off here, I will send you the one I just read on the transmission and distribution.
Okay.
Thank you, guys. Have a nice weekend.
All right. You too. Thanks so much.
Yeah, you too. Thanks. Bye.
Bye.